Ja, liebe Kolleginnen und Kollegen, liebe Studierende, liebe Gäste, herzlich willkommen zum Start des Institutskolloquiums, denn das ist das hier, auch wenn es hier auf unserem Plakat nicht draufsteht, aber es handelt sich hier um das Institutskolloquium in diesem Semester. Ich begrüße euch, Sie, im Namen des Forschungslabors Europa, Europäisierung, das die Vortragsreihe gemeinsam mit mir konzipiert und organisiert hat. Das war uns klar, dass dieser Raum möglicherweise ziemlich voll werden wird, was heute schon der Fall ist, wie man sieht. Denn wir hatten schon im Vorfeld sehr viel Interesse signalisiert bekommen an unserem Programm. Wir wollten aber trotzdem nicht so gern ins Hauptgebäude umziehen, weil wir den Charme dieses Instituts eigentlich dann doch vorziehen, einen zwar größeren, aber eben auch anonymeren, repräsentativen Raum im Hauptgebäude. Insofern hoffe ich jetzt, dass ihr die Enge aus dieser Perspektive auch positiv umdeutet, nämlich als diskussionsfördernde Nähe. Vor knapp 5 Jahren hat das Kolloquium dieses Instituts Europa schon mal programmatisch zur Diskussion gestellt. Damals ging es um ein Turn to Europe, also um die Aufforderung, Europa nicht als scheinbar gegebenes Forschungsfeld der europäischen Ethnologie zu betrachten, sondern Europa selbst, beziehungsweise auch die Prozesse, mit denen es historisch und aktuell hergestellt wird, zum Gegenstand des Faches zu machen. An diesen Turn to Europe knüpfen wir jetzt mit diesem Kolloquium mit einer neuen Fragestellung an. Denn so wichtig und richtig eine reflexive und kritische Betrachtung der laufenden Prozesse der Europäisierung aus ethnologischer Perspektive ist, so sehr läuft dies dennoch auch Gefahr, einen eigenen Eurozentrismus schon wieder zu entwickeln. Nämlich dergestalt eben diese Prozesse dann als scheinbar selbstgeneriertes, mehr oder weniger autonomes europäisches Projekt zu verstehen und damit Europa erneut ins Zentrum der Welt und ins Zentrum der ethnologischen Perspektive auf Welt zu stellen. Der Ausgangspunkt unserer Überlegungen hier war die gegenwärtige Krise Europas, die jetzt ja schon wieder aus den Schlagzeilen verschwunden ist, aber im Sommer doch noch sehr drastisch allen vor Augen geführt hat, dass die beanspruchte Handlungsmacht, die Definitionsmacht, die beanspruchte Zentralität Europas angesichts solcher Entwicklungen auch an ihre Grenzen stößt. Entwicklungen, die unter dem Schlagwort Finanzkrise wahrscheinlich auch nur sehr oberflächlich beschrieben sind. Wir wollen jetzt im Prinzip auch die Krise, die wir im Moment im Raum haben, mit zum Anlass nehmen, zu sehen, dass wir Europa und die Entwicklung eigentlich nur verstehen können vor dem Hintergrund einer langen Geschichte von globalen Verflechtungen und Interdependenzen, in die Europa selbst eingebunden ist und von denen es auch selbst abhängig ist, und Entwicklungen, die sich jetzt fortsetzen mit globalen Migrationen, mit sich verschiebenden Grenzen, mit komplizierter werdenden Kräfte- und Machtverhältnissen. Insofern wollen wir hier Europa als Teil oder als Provinz einer postkolonialen, postsozialistischen, multipolaren Welt thematisieren, es also aus dieser globalen Perspektive dezentrieren. Das ist das Thema, was wir in diesem Kolloquium ausleuchten wollen. Mit Blick auf unser Fach wollen wir damit auch versuchen, eine doppelte Lücke zu schließen. Denn einerseits ist so eine postkoloniale globale Perspektive in der europäischen Ethnologie und auch in anderen mit Europa befassten Fächern eher immer noch Mangelware. Und andererseits ist aber auch Europa bisher kaum explizit zu einem Thema in der postkolonialen Diskussion gemacht worden. In eigentümlicher Weise wiederholt sich also in dieser wissenschaftlichen Arbeitsteilung gewissermaßen die Spaltung der Welt in den Westen und den Rest. Wie diese Spaltung zugunsten eines neuen, dezentrierten Blicks auf Europa überwunden werden kann, ist die Frage, die uns hier beschäftigen wird. Und wir freuen uns, dass wir damit eine ganze Reihe zu diesem Thema sehr ausgewiesener, namhafter Anthropologinnen und Sozialwissenschaftler aus dem In- und Ausland begeistern konnten und auch dafür gewinnen konnten, hier einen Vortrag zu halten. Den Anfang macht jetzt Shalini Randeria, und wir hätten für diesen Auftakt niemand geeigneteren finden können als sie. Denn mit ihrer Position einer geteilten Geschichte, verwobener Modernen, hat sie Europa ganz in unserem Sinne neu zur Diskussion gestellt. Und das sogar schon vor fast 10 Jahren in ihrem gemeinsam mit Sebastian Konrad herausgegebenen Buch Jenseits des Ethnozentrismus, postkoloniale Perspektiven in den Geschichts- und Kulturwissenschaften. Damit gehört sie zu den wenigen Ethnologinnen, die Europa ganz explizit in den Kontext kolonialer, postkolonialer Entwicklung und Verflechtung stellen. Auch ihr jüngstes Buch zeugt von dieser Blickrichtung. Das erschien 2009 und wurde gemeinsam mit Andreas Eckert geschrieben. Titel: Vom Imperialismus zum Empire, nicht-westliche Perspektiven auf Globalisierung. Shalini Randeria forscht vor allem in Indien und Südasien. Sie beschäftigt sich mit Fragen des Postkolonialismus und der Multiple Modernities, mit Globalisierung, Governance und Recht. Sie war unter anderem Fellow hier am Berliner Wissenschaftskolleg und sie war Max Weber Professorin für Soziologie in München. Zurzeit lehrt sie als Professorin am Ethnologischen Seminar in Zürich, ist aber jetzt ganz aktuell auch als Fellow am Lichtenberg-Kolleg in Göttingen unterwegs. Wir freuen uns ganz besonders, dass sie heute hier ist, und ihr zuliebe haben wir es gewagt, ein Kolloquium, was üblicherweise dienstags stattfindet, an einem Montag zu beginnen. Das ist ein ganz besonderes Privileg. Shalini wird ihren Vortrag auf Englisch halten, aber wir können anschließend mit ihr selbstverständlich auch auf Deutsch diskutieren. Und damit ihr danach nicht alle gleich aufbrecht, hier schon mal der Hinweis, dass wir anschließend gemeinsam mit ihr essen gehen wollen in ein nahes Lokal. Und für die mit den Kolloquiumsmodalitäten hier Vertrauten sage ich schon mal, es wird nicht das Löwenbräu sein. Wohin wir gehen, verraten wir aber erst nachher. Die Spannung bleibt also, und wer mitkommen möchte, ist natürlich herzlich eingeladen. Wir haben die auch schon vorgewarnt, dass da vielleicht ein paar Leute kommen heute Abend. Jetzt also zum Thema des heutigen Eröffnungsvortrags unseres Institutskolloquiums. Der Titel lautet: Wie könnte es jetzt anders sein? Entangled Modernities, Postcolonial Perspectives on Europe. Shalini, the floor is yours.
Vielen Dank, Regina, für die Einladung. Vielen Dank auch für die sehr großzügige Einführung. Und es tut mir leid, dass Sie aus dem gewohnten Rhythmus herausgekommen sind und an einem schönen, sonnigen Montag, heute nicht mehr, aber es war schön, als ich das Institut suchte und fälschlicherweise Mohrenstraße ausgestiegen bin und hier die Gegend mir angeguckt habe, habe ich gedacht, heute Abend kommt niemand. An so einem schönen Abend hat man Besseres zu tun, als sich über postkoloniale Theorie etwas erzählen zu lassen. Also lassen Sie mich erstmal mit 3 Anekdoten anfangen. Ich werde auf Englisch vortragen, geben Sie mir aber ein Zeichen, wenn ich zu schnell sein sollte. Ich glaube, vom Stimmenvolumen her, Sie werden mich schon hinten hören können. Ich kann auch lauter sprechen, also das ist nicht das Problem. Aber einfach ein Zeichen geben, falls es zu schnell geht. I would like to start with 3 anecdotes. One will slightly revise the history of the genesis of the idea of entangled modernities. But I think they are instructive anecdotes. Today, when I'm invited very often to give talks about postcolonial theory, about entangled modernities, Europe in a postcolonial perspective, I'm always surprised at the popularity of this particular point of view, of this perspective, because you cannot imagine how much has changed in the last 10 years. I came up with the idea in 1999, and it has a double origin. One, in 1999, I was invited to Essen, to KWE, Kulturwissenschaftliches Institut in Essen, to give a talk on Indian conceptions of modernity, and it was very clear that this could only be in a comparative perspective. The comparative perspective was that I was supposed to say something about India, there was a Chinese colleague who was supposed to say something about China, somebody from Africa was supposed to say something about Africa, and all of us were supposed to, of course, implicitly or explicitly compare the trajectories, paths, patterns of modernity against what would be the European standard. I disturbed this entire comparative project by saying, I don't want to talk about India. I would like to look at Europe as a product of eine geteilte Geschichte. And geteilt war in beidem Sinne des deutschen Begriffes gemeint, geteilt im Sinne von gemeinsam und geteilt auch im Sinne von getrennt. Und das war die erste Begrifflichkeit, die ich für mich fand, um einfach diesen Zusammenhang darzustellen, was immer als unterschiedliche Geschichten dargestellt und wahrgenommen wird. The next stage in the career of this idea, the word postcolonial was nowhere on the scene in Germany. In the US, there were debates about postcolonial theory, but this was more of a literary enterprise. There were many who were great fans of Gayatri Spivak or Bhabha, but there were also very many critiques of this particular perspective. The book, which of course in here as also in the US was a very important source of inspiration for all of us, was Edward Said's Orientalism. Unfortunately, the German translation is terrible, so please don't read it. It should be read in the English original, and naturally it deserves a new translation. But the German reception had been partly because of a poor translation, but partly, I think, because it just did not catch any kind of, didn't have a spark. It didn't lead to a rethinking of any of the paradigms which it should have. The German reception of Orientalism is something which comes in much later in 2000, in the wake of the discussion on postcolonial theory. The second genesis, and that is when the idea of Verflechtung, entanglement, came up, was in the context of, in 2000, Ulrich Beck invited me to write a piece for the journal Soziale Welt, which he edits. It's a sociology journal, and the his idea was there should be an issue at the turn of the century, at the millennium. He invited a number of us, younger scholars, sociologists, and to think about the future of the discipline. And I wrote a piece called Beyond, Jenseits von Soziologie und Soziokulturelle Anthropologie, saying that this division of disciplinary labor between sociology and anthropology was historically a division of labor which made no sense, but today it makes even less sense. And this was sort of the double genesis of rethinking not only the object of our inquiry. In your case, if you are your anthropologist of Europe, Europe. In my case, I was a sociologist of India until I was turned into an anthropologist in Germany. I'll say something about that in a minute. But so it was about rethinking the boundaries of the objects. What are the units of analysis, and does it make sense to think about the units of analysis the way we have been thinking about them in our disciplines? So in the course of this came up the idea of entanglements, translated then into German as Verflechtungsgeschichte. And today, as in fact I was quite proud of this when I was told in Brussels the other day at the European Research Council meeting where we were judging grant proposals, someone came up to me not knowing anything about my association with Verflechtung or entanglements, said, "Heutzutage kann man sich von Verflechtung gar nicht mehr retten." And I thought, wonderful. But it was a very, very difficult notion for two reasons. One, because the usual reaction in Germany 10 years ago was to say, India is a post-colonial society, British, of course, colonized India, but we have very little as Germans to do with colonialism. Wir hatten ganz wenige Kolonien, die haben wir sehr früh verloren, die hatten überhaupt keinen Einfluss auf die deutsche Geschichte. Also eigentlich geht es uns nichts an. This was the usual reflex to anything about postcolonial theory, and it took a long time to convince people that it's not just I who come from a postcolonial country, but that we all live in a postcolonial world. And that part of the reason to rethink a lot of this, what I'm going to present to you today, is not just because the objects of inquiry need to be rethought and disciplinary boundaries need to be rethought, but also because I think the way in which you frame and ask certain questions will lead you to find very, very different answers. So I hope to be able to show you both that there is a methodological purchase, which is important in thinking of certain problems in terms of entanglements and not in terms of normal comparative sociology or comparative history, and also to try and show why is it that we can ask certain questions with this kind of a perspective. This is my second anecdote, is about the discipline of sociology and anthropology. I came to Germany, hard to believe, in the year 1982. It's been a long time. And when I came and wanted to do a PhD in sociology, but on India, the first reaction was, das machen wir nicht. Eigentlich, also Indien ist nicht funktional differenziert, Indien ist keine moderne Gesellschaft. Es wäre etwas schwierig, eine Doktorarbeit über Soziologie Indiens in der Soziologie zu schreiben. Warum gehen Sie nicht zu den Ethnologen? Also gehe ich zu den Ethnologen, um zu hören, Indien ist eigentlich kein Gegenstand der Ethnologie. Was man nicht natürlich gesagt hat, ist, Indien ist nicht primitiv genug, um Gegenstand der Ethnologie zu sein. Aber Lehrstühle für Ethnologie Indiens gab es kaum. Und da habe ich angefangen, darüber nachzudenken, also was für einen Sinn macht diese disziplinäre Aufteilung zwischen Ethnologie und Soziologie. So here we have a problem where Europe is in the center of this disciplinary division of labor. And Europe is here in the center for two reasons. One is a historical reason, the other is the reason of Eurocentrism. Eurocentrism is inscribed in the very disciplinary division of labor because sociology belongs to the disciplines like political science and economics, which are nation-centered, and nation-centered in the sense of European nation-centered. So it was an implicit and sometimes very explicit methodological nationalism, that conceptual nationalism, that societies, polities, and economies were contained in nation states. And therefore, the three disciplines, sociology, political science, and economics, were all nation state bound disciplines. And then you compared. You compared one nation state, one society, one polity, one economy with the other. Also within Europe, usually. What happened to the rest of the world? So the West was contained in these disciplines, and the rest of the world was divided into either primitive societies, which were the object of anthropology, or there were societies to which the Germans said, das sind Hochkulturen. And if they are Hochkulturen, that is, they have writing, they have a Hochreligion, then they are the subject of philologies, Indology, Sinology, Islamwissenschaften, all of them historical philological disciplines. Anthropology had as its object societies without Hochkultur, Hochreligion, and without writing. So you've got a threefold discipline of a division of labor in which we now have to, of course, add to the story where comes European ethnology into this story. And of course, this is a division within European societies in which Volkskunde became the repository of knowledge about those parts of European society which were not modern, which were, one didn't probably use the term primitive, but that's something which you will have to look into your own disciplinary history to find out. But here at least was a division within your society in Europe, which set it off as a discipline which was different from European sociology, from sociology. So that there is a notion of a unilinear teleological notion of what modernization is about, both within a society and between societies, which is at the heart of the way, even today, in the early 21st century, our disciplinary division of labor is functioning. And I think it's important to question this particular division of labor, because this has, on the whole, turned the objects, non-European societies, the objects of anthropology, and also the original objects of Volkskunde, into what Dipesh Chakravarti very nicely says: these are societies which we can only conceptualize in terms of either lacks or lags. Either there is a time lack or there is a lack. So it's a lacks and lags theory which really leads us to this particular kind of division of labor. Okay. As against this kind of Eurocentrism, which saw Europe as the norm, the standard, the measure by which we could either measure lacks or lags, I came up with the idea of entanglements. And of course, as you can imagine, there were not very many takers for this particular idea. And I was very happy then when I found that Salman Rushdie had, in The Midnight's Children, a character called Biski Sisodia, if you remember. And Biski Sisodia says something which would sum up my whole lecture for this evening. Actually, you can just hear this one sentence and we can call it quits, because he really has the idea of entanglement in one sentence, where he says that the British are unfortunately unaware of their own history because so much of their history happened overseas. And this is exactly the story of geteilte Geschichte, which I tried to bring in into the center of what I wanted to do with the idea of entangled modernities. Now, the idea of entangled modernities is something I came up with before Eisenstadt, Shmuel Eisenstadt, in the year 2000, came up with his very famous article in Daedalus on multiple modernities. In a way, if I'm critical, and I will be critical of Shmuel Eisenstadt in a moment, this is because I owe him a great debt of intellectual gratitude. For those of you who do not know of Eisenstadt's work and do not know, he passed away just last month, and therefore, in a way, it's a small tribute for me also to be in a very critical dialogue, but a critical dialogue which I had with him in the last 15 years. We have been debating very many issues, and among them, the idea of multiple modernities. Now, Eisenstadt's idea to pluralize modernity has been concerned with two sets of issues. One is, what are the different paths of modernity, the trajectories of modernity in different parts of the world? And secondly, differences in the outcomes of these processes in different societies. So he talks about the paths and the patterns of modernity. This, of course, raises an important question, and the question is, what is the relationship between European and non-European modernities? which were developed under highly asymmetrical conditions of domination and of exploitation. And the question is, what status would we accord to the paradigm of Western modernity, which in itself Eisenstadt also puts in the plural? Eisenstadt argues that Western modernity must be conceived of in itself as plural because American modernity is very, very different from European modernity. But for Eisenstadt, the standard is still the Western path and pattern from which he looks at in a very barbarian. There is something very, very barbarian in the way the whole project is framed, and I'll say something about that in a moment. It's about the combinations of different elements of modernity and the ways in which they are combined differently in different societies. So if we have a musical analogy, I would say it's about variations on a theme. And the theme is a Western theme, and then you can vary it in the way you play this theme in India or in China or in Africa. Anthropologists who have been working with the idea of alternative modernities or vernacular modernities have emphasized the creative and the selective translations, appropriations. These are the metaphors with which anthropologists have looked at the domestication of Western modernity in many postcolonial societies in what they consider to be a set of hybrid outcomes. Now, my notion of entangled modernities is posited also against a lot of anthropological writing on modernities, because my feeling, maybe this is being uncharitable to some of my colleagues, but my feeling has been that the anthropological response to the embrace of universal brotherhood has been to say there are islands of otherhood. So in order to escape this universalizing embrace of a teleological modernizing narrative, the anthropologists have chosen to say, but there is an African modernity which is different. There is an Indian modernity which is different, or there is a Chinese modernity which is different. And here, there are two problems, I think, which we come up with. One is, in my view, a substantive problem, which is the problem that we are back into a nation-state framework. We assume that there is something which is a Chinese modernity, something which is an Indian modernity, so that the unit of analysis for which modernity is now being analyzed is pre-given. I think the idea of entanglements is methodologically more interesting because it does not start from a preconceived unit. It says, let's look at a problem. And depending on the problem, we will then see where these entanglements in space and time take us. And so the space is neither the space of the nation state, nor is it the space of, for Eisenstadt, civilizations. So Eisenstadt, as I said, is a Weberian. For him, different modernities are civilizational modernities. So for him, Indian modernity is a Hindu modernity, the Chinese modernity is a Confucian modernity, Eisenstadt is interested in Islamic modernities, and for him, there are variations of Christian modernity in the US and in Europe. I think there is no reason to prejudge the issue of religion, as there is no reason to prejudge the issue whether civilization or a nation state is the unit in which we want to think about the entanglements, but that we can follow entanglements in space and time, and we can see space itself as not naturalized in a nation state, but that this space itself is a product of historical entanglements. So it turns the question around, if you see what I mean. Maybe it'll be clearer in a moment. Okay. For anthropologists, of course, modernity is also a question of social experience. And the social experience of modernity varies in the understandings and practices of different groups of people within a society. So that I have often written of entangled but also uneven modernities. And that there is an unevenness of texture unevenness of the parts, unevenness of patterns of modernity within a society, and which is where I think this is an idea which, especially for a discipline which came from Volkskunde, this is something which could help rethink the ideas of how within a society there are different rhythms of modernity, there are different patterns of modernity, there are different textures of modernity that we can look at as parts of subjective experience. So that for us as anthropologists, I would argue, as against sociologists, for whom modernity is a theoretical, analytical category, for us as anthropologists, modernity is also a native category. Because people whom we do field work with are talking about their own experiences all the time in terms of being backward, non-backward, modern, non-modern, traditional, non-traditional, so that it's not modernity, it's just not an analytical category alone, but it is also a category which the subjects of our research use as a category to describe their own experiences. So rather than simply a teleological, historical, philosophical category, as part of the Enlightenment project, for us as anthropologists, modernity becomes a dimension of social experience and a part of the social imaginary which is acted and reflected upon. So the argument that I was trying to make with the idea of entangled modernities was as much an argument against modernization theory and its unilinear universal teleology as also an argument against alternative modernities, by saying that rather than an alternative modernities perspective, it's important to have a relational perspective. And this relational perspective foregrounds historical processes of interaction. Historical processes of interaction, which in my case, I mean, if one goes back in Eisenstadt's kind of framework, then one would have to go back to the Axial Age. One can go back in the work of the Indian historian Sanjay Subramaniam. One would go back to the 16th and 17th centuries. But in the kind of work that I have done, one can go back to colonialism and to imperialism as the framework for interaction which forms today's entities. It forms Europe as we know it as an entity, just as it forms the other, Europe's others as entities. So that it's not as if we could privilege Western historical experience or its trajectories, but we need to be sensitive to these as formed due to, through processes of interaction or entanglements. Okay. Now, I say this because I think the nation-state has become a very, very strong iron cage of historical and social imagination. Ulrich Beck, whom you will be hearing in this series of lectures, has written a lot about a critique of methodological nationalism. And I think that this territorial space of the nation-state has been seen as a pre-constituted geographical unit of historical and social research. And this is what Neil Brenner, for example, calls methodological territorialism in a very famous essay in 1999. And he says the problem with this methodological territorialism is, and I quote him, it produces an internalist model of societal development in which territoriality operates as a static and timeless container of history. Now, we have, of course, alternative frameworks. And the alternative frameworks is, as I said, in the case of Eisenstadt, it's a civilizational framework, but we have new approaches to global history. We have globalization theory, we have world systems theory, we have world society, world culture in sociology, very many approaches which challenge this kind of nationalism. However, one of the problems with these approaches is that they break with the nation state by denying its significance or its relevance altogether. And I think the perspective of entangled histories allows us to see transnational interaction as one dimension without prejudicing the question of sites and scales of entanglement. So that historically, I think it's interesting to say that globalization and nationalism, and that's an important point for me, even historically, globalization and nationalization have proceeded in tandem instead of being opposed to one another. In fact, in order to, or if we look at the spatial turn in this case, we will see that the naturalization of the nation-state space is something which needs to be questioned. So that space must be seen as constitutive. It's constitutive dimension of social relations and itself a product of historical processes rather than as pre-given. I think that's an important point, which is methodologically an important point to bear in mind. The other point which is important is that colonialism, unlike the normal description of colonialism is not a one-way street. It's not a billiard ball game in which the West hits a ball and this ball has an effect in India or in South Africa or in Indonesia or in Spain, from Spain to Latin America. But, I mean, this is the billiard ball model. Yeah, that there is, from one side, there is an action and the other side only reacts to something which has happened in the West. I think it's important to see colonialism as a two-way street, to see it as an interactive process, and that is what I'm going to do now in the next 15-20 minutes, is to make an argument for why we need to see the West itself, the modern West itself, as a part of a historical interaction within an imperial framework. And if we look at it this way, we ask different set of questions, we open up many areas of inquiry, and we see then that colonialism itself was constitutive of modernity, both in the colonies and in the metropolitan centers. So that rather than seeing colonialism as something which is external to Europe, and to seeing a non-Western world as separate from European history and European society, as Salman Rushdie reminds us, a lot of the history of Europe took place outside it. But that is still European history, or if you like, non-European history is then as much part of the history of Europe as it is a part of the history of the space on which it actually took place. Now, just before I come to this, one more theoretical point, because I don't know those of you who may come from sociology. I myself am a sociologist by training as much as an anthropologist. The interesting thing for those of you who come from sociology or are looking at sociological theory is to just look back and say, which of the classical or modern sociologists do you know who have thought through colonialism and imperialism in their sociological theories? And the answer will be hardly any. And this is, of course, a very surprising answer for someone like me, who was taught to read Weber, Durkheim, Tönnies, Simmel, Habermas, Luhmann, sitting in India. And while reading all of these people, it struck us, of course, from outside the West, that there is a blank spot in this theory. And it's interesting to think, why is it that there is this particular blank spot in these theories? Marx is an exception. Marx, of course, has a very positive view on the whole of colonialism, but we can come to that later in the discussion. But if we leave aside Marx, and then, of course, Wallerstein with world systems theory has a great deal of theorizing on both colonialism and imperialism. But if we leave that aside, none of the founding fathers of sociology have incorporated the experience of colonialism or imperialism, although they are all thinking about the foundations of European modernity. And all of them, especially Weber or Durkheim, they are in a particular sense not Eurocentric, because if you remember, Weber has a very large comparative project. So it's not as if Weber is not thinking about India or China. Durkheim also has a comparative project. Durkheim and Mohs' primitive classification is very much about classificatory systems, which and where do they go when they look for the other? They go to Australian Aborigines. They are looking at Durkheim and elementary forms of religious life is also looking at the simple forms in order to come to an understanding of European processes of modern societal formation. So it's not as if they are not thinking of a world beyond Europe. Yeah, but there is no reflection in this process. And these are some of the most highly reflexive intellectuals in Europe. And yet there is this absolute blank spot in this theory. And I think postcolonial theory comes in order to put its finger onto the space and say, something is missing here. We need to rethink how Europe has viewed its own history and its own understanding, its own representation of its own modernity. Because European modernity is conceived of as a sui generis modernity. It is modernity in which Europe is on the one hand universal, but on the other hand unique. And I think this is where part of the trouble lies when Europe conceives itself itself as both universal and unique. You get into a lot of the paradoxes of sociological theory about non-European societies. Okay, let me leave it at that and make maybe just two points before I look at one or a couple of problems, but no, let me make three points about sociological theory and then I'll go on to a history of Europe. There has been, of course, and I said Marx was very, very interested in the nature of colonialism. Marx was very interested in the nature of colonialism. Marx and Marxist thinkers have had a lot to say about the effects of colonialism, of imperial rule, on both the colonies and as providing the economic foundations for the industrialization of Europe. And therefore, interestingly, when you have Marxists trying to write against Eurocentrism, you have an attempt like André Gunde Frank recently, 1998. He has a book called Reorient. And Reorient by André Gunde Frank tries to decenter Europe, but he tries to decenter Europe by reversing the story. So instead of putting Europe in the center of the story, he puts Asia in the center of the story. So this is a story in which he tries to reverse the value accorded to Asia by replacing Europe at the center of a particular universal history of capital by putting Asia in the center of this history. And therefore, it's an attempt to marginalize Europe by turning around the story. It's still, I think, a highly economic deterministic perspective. It, of course, is an attempt to overcome methodological nationalism. It also looks at transnational processes of exchange between colonies and the metropole, but it is unable to look at processes of cultural imperialism because it's very economically determinist in its outlook, in a way, a child of world systems theory and of Wallerstein's kind of ideas. And it is unable to do anything else but reverse the terms of this debate. Now, let me come for a moment to my critique of Eisenstadt, and you will see what the problem with overcoming methodological nationalism but using a civilizational paradigm and a Weberian paradigm based on differences rooted in religion is. So I think Eisenstadt is absolutely right when he stresses the inner plurality of Christianity by equating the European complex with Christian civilizations in the plural. But He conceives then of Hinduism on the other side of the story of Indian modernity as a monolithic religion. And like Weber, he derives the civilizational unity of India by treating India as synonymous with Hinduism. So it's the Indian civilization or the Hinduistic civilization. Now, such a view, to my mind, underplays not only the significance of pluralities within Hinduism, and there's a lot which we could say about Hinduism as a category, but that's something I don't want to do for now, but also of the long history of interactions and intermingling across civilizations. Because India has had, of course, 700-800 years of Islam on the subcontinent to write the history of Indian modernity as derived from Hinduism totally neglects the fact that Islam is as much part of Indian civilizations as Hinduism is today. So an analysis of multiple modernities with its emphasis on separate civilizational roots, R-O-U-T-E-S, roots, is unable to accommodate the historical entanglements which decisively shaped, in my view, not only pre-modern civilizations, but also contemporary configurations of modernity. Of course, Eisenstadt's idea of multiple modernities is great advance on a normal modernization narrative. But by positing endogenous, autonomous, culturalist trajectories of development of civilizations as units of analysis, more or less explicitly defined in terms of religion, such an approach ignores a long history of flows of exchange, material culture, cultural exchanges across these civilizational boundaries. I think among the sociologists, the person who has been the most innovative in using Eisenstadt's approach, but going beyond it in order to look at some of these kinds of interactions, is Johan Arneson. Johan Arneson has, in his study of the Soviet Union, and I think that is something which for European anthropologists, ethnologists, should be an interesting book to look at. Johan Arneson's study of the Soviet Union looks at the nature of Soviet modernity as another variation of Western modernity, so that he pluralizes Western modernity, but not only along civilizational or along religious lines, as Eisenstadt. And then he looks at differences within this homogeneous category of Western modernity by looking at Soviet modernity as a very different variant of Western modernity. He has also done a very interesting analysis of the modernization of Japan. And Japan is interesting because if you remember Stuart Hall has always said the West and the rest, in which the Japan in which Japan is the honorary member of the Western Club. So therefore, it's interesting to look at Japan as a case of a different kind of modernity. And in Arneson's analysis of Japan, he has looked at the cultural foundations of Japanese modernity. I think the problem, however, with Arneson as much as with Eisenstadt here is both of them emphasize cultural factors because they are trying to overcome the Marxist bias in favor of economic factors. However, what they miss out is the violence of colonialism, of forced integration into a world economy, and the fragmentation of societies through this kind of a process of integration. So that this kind of a comparative civilizational analysis, which Arneson follows Eisenstadt in doing, there is little discussion of the asymmetry of power. There is very little idea of cultural imperialism, and there is a very little idea of the interaction which forms Western modernity as part of this global modernity in the imperial context as well. Okay, let me come to the last part of my talk, where I want to look at some of the discussions on colonialism and its constitutive role for the formation of Western modernity. I'm going to skip here quite a lot. Okay. One side effect of using a comparative research perspective, not an entanglement perspective, but a traditional comparative perspective, is that the kind of comparisons that we have had both in sociology and in history as disciplines are comparisons which always have contrasts in their center. So it is always differences which we look at, differences from the West, rather than similarities or interactions. These kinds of comparisons always stress discontinuity rather than continuities. And therefore, the historical and comparative experience of non-Western societies, when it's understood in this kind of a comparative framework, is, as Mehmood Mamdani says, it is a history of absences. It is the history of what is not in the non-West, rather than a history of what is. But I think what is interesting as a problem here is that it is not just an idealized image of the West and an idealized image of the other, of the West, which is created here, but there is a historical essentialization of the West as well. And the West comes then to be defined by the abstraction of a few historical features of a few Western societies, which are Northern Western European societies. So that I think we need to rethink what kind of European experience in its plurality flows into this construction of the West, which is then abstracted as the liberal, secular, democratic, modern industrial West, which is then compared to the rest, who are missing all of these kinds of characteristics. So there is a supra-historical trajectory then to the development of Western societies, which are posited as a necessary path of development rather than the contingency of this path. And I think if one looks at entanglements, one has the advantage of being able to explore a lot of the contingencies of this development rather than seeing this as the inevitable, necessary path of development, because there is a almost suprahistorical, hyperreal nature which is ascribed to the development of a particular range of societies within Europe itself. So the perspective of entangled modernities would argue against seeing a single coherent idea of modernity as emerging fully formed in Europe, but rather show how various and often contradictory European ideas of modernity were creatively used and developed further outside the confines of Europe. So instead of judging the degree of successful diffusion and domestication of a Western-defined universal, it may be more fruitful to analyze the politics of the strategic and rhetorical deployment of various conceptions of modernity, which were variously domesticated in a diversity of contexts outside the West in accordance with different theoretical tastes and also political agendas. These dialogues with Western modernity expand or modify a lot of its ideas, but they also remain in part uncomfortable with and distrustful of Western modernity. I remind you of this very famous interview when Mahatma Gandhi is asked by a young British journalist in the 1930s, "Mr. Gandhi, what do you think of Western civilization?" And Gandhi says, "It would be a good idea." Now, why does he think it would be a good idea? Because looking at Western modernity from a colony one is able to see a lot of its illiberality, one has experienced a lot of its violence, one has experienced a lot of its exploitation. And the story that Europe tells about itself is not a story that can be taken at face value if you are looking at the history of Europe from outside it. Now, just let me remind you, for those of you who have forgotten or not yet read Frantz Fanon or Aimé Césaire, that both of them conceived of fascism in Europe as European colonialism brought home to the continent by a country deprived of its overseas empires after World War I. Interestingly, this is also a view of German fascism, which Hannah Arendt held, that this German fascism was European colonialism brought home. So you have European thinkers like Arendt who have had a conceptualization which she doesn't develop at great length, but she has this idea of linking these two histories together. The kind of work that a lot of people have done in the last few years, Catherine Hall, Anne McClintock, of course Stuart Hall, has shown, of course, the ways in which British national culture, British identity has been formed as part of the colonial project. And Stoller's work, Fred Cooper's work, has shown and Anne Stoller's work has shown in particular how Dutch ideas of citizenship are formed in interaction with the racism of the colonies in Indonesia. So that if we keep these kinds of historical trajectories in mind, of course, we need to remind ourselves that by the 19th century, when a large part of the world was under British rule, colonial resources and markets gave a fillip to industrialization in Europe. The City of London emerged as the financial center of international trade. British balance of payments came to depend on a complex network of multilateral settlements in a system which was linked to the expansion of empire. Similarly, the rise of transnational corporations from the East India Company, so the East India Company, the Dutch East India Company, the British East India Company were very good examples of transnational corporations. And they behaved like transnational corporations today. All of them asked for protection from their governments at home in order to conquer markets abroad, and none of them wanted to pay taxes at home. So it's a story which, if we go back to looking at the history of transnational corporations as the trading companies, as corporations, it's a history which has a lot of resonances with the transnational corporations today. And as current debates on globalization force us to reassess the relationship between transnational enterprise and the nation state, it forces us to ask questions about the dilution or the dissolution of territorial sovereignty of the state. It may be fruitful to consider these issues in a historical perspective, which is more sensitive to continuities in an imperial context rather than the discontinuities. Let me remind you, for those of you who did not have to learn British history, we of course had to learn British history in school, that the then British Prime Minister Gladstone, who authorized an invasion of Egypt in 1882, what was the justification for waging the war on Egypt? He said in Parliament, "This is a just war, it's a holy war against militant Islam," in 1882. And of course, interestingly, Gladstone had 37% of his personal investment portfolio in Egyptian stock. This is a story not unfamiliar to those of us looking at the background of the Iraq War. Now, for you in Germany, it might be interesting to know that the British considered their civilization mission not to be at an end after decolonization. In 1945, when Britain was trying to administer parts of Germany, where do you think it got the experts from who were now to turn Germany into a modern liberal nation? These were British bureaucrats who had come from India. So British bureaucrats who had been posted in India were then brought in with their colonial experience to turn Germany into a modern nation. So there is a whole lot of interactions which we have not been looking at. Interactions of the kind that we do not look at because we look at these histories separately. And among the kinds of interactions we have not been looking at are interactions among the colonies. What very little history, I mean, as it's beginning to be written now, is the history of how the interactions are between Africa and India, between the Caribbean and India, between Africa and the Caribbean. So if we are looking at Verflechtungsgeschichte, then we need Verflechtungsgeschichte of the colonies with one another as well, and not just a history which links the colonies and the European metropolitan systems. So we have to look at the connections between Africa, North and South American colonies, between indentured labor on sugar plantations, which connected India to the Caribbean, the Fijis, or to Southern Africa. So along with the forced displacement of people, languages, practices of family and kinship, religious beliefs and rituals, performative and narrative genres, traditions of healing traveled along with ideologies of race and empire from colony to colony as much as they traveled from the colony to Europe or from Europe to the colonies. If colonies then were the laboratories of metropolitan modernity, in that many technologies of governmentality, to put it in a Foucauldian language, were tried out in the colonies before they were reimported into Europe. So many administrative institutions like indirect rule or practices of surveillance in prisons or in public health were tried out in the colonies. The French tried out cadastral mapping in their colonies before they could do cadastral mapping in France itself. The British tried out fingerprinting as a technology in India before fingerprinting was introduced into Britain. And, for example, even the subject, English literature, as it is taught in British universities today, is a subject, a discipline, which was formed in India. You didn't need to teach British children about British literature in the 19th century. You taught British children, of course, the classics. If you wanted to train the mind, you taught them classics. But whose minds did you need to train in the colonies? The minds of the Indian bureaucrats whom you wanted to rule in the name of British Empire, and they were then taught British English literature. And so English literature was formed as a subject in the part of the curriculum for the colonies, re-imported then into England, re-imported then all over Europe. So it's an interesting history of how a discipline was formed here. Another interesting history, I think, which could be told very, very differently from the way it's told today, is the story of European secularization. Europe tells the story about itself as being secularized in 19th century, in the early 20th century. Europe is secular. This is a story which can only be told as long as you forget that this is the time when Europe is sending hundreds and thousands of missionaries to Africa, to India, to Southeast Asia. So the story of mission abroad is tied into the story of secularization at home. And these are two stories which, for example, in the work of John and Jean Komarov, they tell a very interesting and complicated story of how the poor in London are missionized at the same time as missionaries are sent by the same missionary societies to Africa. And the poor in London are talked about as dark Africa in London. So here is an entanglement of race and class and in two spaces across two continents which need to be put together if we want to look at the history of missions or of secularization. Peter van der Weer has in 2001 a very, very interesting study for those of you who are interested in the history of religion, where he shows how changes in the place and understanding of religion in both England and in India in the 19th century, he traces the histories of Hinduism and of Protestantism as they change in this period, and he looks at them in a shared colonial context to show that they undergo, both Protestantism and Hinduism undergo similar processes of modernization and nationalization in two very different locations. So there are questions related to the nature of Christianity. I think if you've looked at Christopher Bailey's work, I think it's even more surprising here, because what Christopher Bailey shows is that the expansion of Islam under the protection of a Protestant empire is an unexpected and unintended consequence of imperial rule. This is Bailey's work, a book called The Imperial Meridian, the British Empire and the World, 1780 to 1830. There's been a lot of work of late in the history of science, especially geography, botany, etc., which shows very, very clearly the colonial origins of these disciplines, how the knowledge which is produced in the 20th century in the colonies on plants, on animals, on medicinal herbs, etc., gets transferred also then to the colonies, so that the colonies are the framework within which a lot of the knowledge in geography, botany, etc., as disciplines is formed. These are the kinds of questions which a lot of colonial historians have been looking at in the last few years, and what they remind us is of what Gayatri Spivak puts it very, very briefly, and I think very, very well, when she says empire messes up identities. Empire messes up identities on both sides. And I think she's very right when she points to the whole question of the imperial legacy of national identity making on both sides of the divide. And this is a field in which there has been a lot of research which has been done of late. The Cambridge historian Anthony Hopkins has argued recently in a book which is an impetus for the volume which Andreas Eckert and I have edited on Von Imperialist Muslim Empire. Anthony Hopkins argues that all three features of the new international disorder are legacies of empire, concealed, however, by national historiographic traditions. The nation-state, whose composition and stability as an agent of modernization is increasingly being called into question, the reemergence of ethnic assertion, and the inability of post-imperial supranational institutions to deal with the contemporary crises, both of the economy and of ecology. Now, let me end by making two general remarks. I've emphasized entanglements as a methodological tool. I've emphasized entanglements of historical processes at various scales, levels, and sites in order to show that a different representation, self-representation, and even conceptualization of Europe and European modernity would be in order by looking at the mutual implications of metropolitan centers and colonial peripheries. To conceptualize modernity as relational, as a product of entanglements and exchange, is, however, problematic for two reasons. One, because it assumes the existence of the West and its others, societies external to the West, long before these binary identities had come to be fixed in such a neatly demarcated Eurocentric fashion. So it may be better to regard these interactions in the domain of sugar plantations in the Caribbean, as Sidney Mintz's work shows on the power of sweetness, or in the school curriculum in India, as Gaudi Vishwanath's work shows, or in the slave trade from Africa, the layout of urban landscapes in Algeria, or on marriage and misogyny rules in Indonesia, and Stoller's work, as decisive for the nature of this dualism. So this dualism between Europe and its others is a dualism which is produced by these kinds of processes in the plantations, in the administration, in school curricula. It's not something which precedes it historically. The notion of entangled modernity that I have proposed cautions against both the risk of nativism and cultural particularism as a strategy to counter Eurocentrism, but also the danger of simply a reverse modernization, which would claim the colonies to be modern in the same way, or even to be modern ahead of the metropole. In seeking to emphasize interactions and entanglements, I do not seek to reverse Eurocentrism, but to decenter Europe by complicating the narrative of modernity and modernization by questioning not only its location, but also its certainties. So I'm concerned not with a critique of modernization in terms of time, but I'm concerned with a critique of modernity in terms of space, in terms of also its location. Overcoming Eurocentrism must, in my view, lead neither to a universal history nor to islands of cultural particularity or nativism. Transcending the boundedness of the nation-state as the privileged unit of analysis and in a container model of society and culture or even civilizations need not involve embracing any idea of unhindered flows and interconnections. And this is the second caveat with which I want to end. This is the second risk of using a notion of entanglements, because one sees then everything is entangled with everything else, equally entangled. And this is not the case. The mere fact of historical entanglement or even current processes of entanglement should not obscure but rather sharpen our sensibilities to the vastly different systems of power and production being connected across continents with very different consequences for different sets of actors in a variety of contexts. So rather than assume diffusion from a European center and take the nation state as a pre-given unit of scholarly analysis, the idea of entanglement, I hope, will help you rethink whatever problem you are working on or plan to work on with a changed optic, and that relational idea of modernity would then analyze not only flows and connections, but also bottlenecks. Bottlenecks in different empirical contexts which trace specific webs of connections and interactions, precise formations of networks and ties, the expansion but also the contraction of linkages over time, and the shifting contours of both real boundaries and also our spatial imaginations in order to look at the uneven nature of these processes in sites which are tied to one another by asymmetries of power and of academic privilege. I think that today can be the most fruitful contribution that postcolonial theory can make to rethinking Europe as an object of inquiry. Thank you.